Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As the Enron scandal unfolds, a great question remains. How deep do the political ties reach? Former Nixon White House counsel John Dean spent 4 months in prison for his role in the Watergate cover-up. He famously said that there was a cancer growing on the Nixon presidency. Is there an Enron cancer still undiscovered in Washington's politics today? This hour, John Dean on Enron, Watergate, and the way of all political scandal. We begin with the latest on a recently released video of American hostages in the Philippines. Reuters news agency has obtained a tape showing an American missionary couple reading a statement from their Abu Sayyaf captors. The date of the tape's origin is unknown. Bob Drogan is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. I asked him what we know about the couple, Martin and Gracia Burnham.
They were kidnapped with a Philippine nurse last May 27th, so 9 months ago, by Abu Sayyaf, and they are being held on an island called Basilan, which is in the southern Philippines. Mr. Martin is chained to a tree or tied to a tree every night. They are under armed guard. This is according to hostages who have been released since their capture, and their whereabouts are now the subject of a manhunt by U.S. Special Forces.
The other American who was kidnapped at the same time, Guillermo Sobero, is believed to have been beheaded by the Abu Sayyaf.
Abu Sayyaf has a long and rather sordid history of ruthless tactics towards the people they have captured. They have are less a terrorist band in the sense of seeking political goals than they have been a kidnap-for-ransom operation in which they have taken over the years dozens of Filipino and Western and other Asian tourists, missionaries, villagers, and whatnot, usually for ransom, but in some cases they have tortured people, beheaded people, and obviously abused them.
But in this case, in the video, it is explicitly stated that Abu Sayyaf is linked to al-Qaeda.
In this video, the Burnhams are forced to read a statement that clearly sounds, has some demands that clearly are in sync with those made by al-Qaeda, specifically complaints about American troops in the Saudi Holy Land, complaints about policy Israel, support for Israel and the policy with the Palestinians, antagonism towards the embargo against Iraq. These are all issues that al-Qaeda has tried to champion. They're somewhat new for Abu Sayyaf, who have not really known to have sharp links to al-Qaeda in the past, certainly not since their early days when there were some questions about their role.
Bob Drogan, we have the sound from that videotape. Let's hear.
I, Martin Burnham, and my wife, Gracia, both U.S. citizens, were taken as captives on May 27, 2001, at the Dos Palmas Beach Resort in Palawan by the Al-Harakatul Islamiyah, or the Abu Sayyaf Group. They are targeting U.S., European, and citizens of other Western nations for the following reasons. One, the continued desecration of the island of Arabia, especially Mecca and Medina, by the presence of U.S. and European troops and their business interests. Two, their support to the illegitimate Israeli regime that occupies Palestine and the holy city of Jerusalem. Three, their continued sanctions on Iraq and Libya that results in the death and sufferings of countless Muslim men, women, and children. Four, their indifference to the plight of Muslims in Chechnya, Kashmir, and other Muslim minorities like those in China, Kosovo, Burma, and others who are being persecuted by their governments. Five, their support to the Philippine government's illegal and immoral annexation and occupation of Muslim land.
The words of Martin Burnham, shown in a video that Reuters news agency has gotten hold of, it shows Martin Burnham and his wife Gracia of Wichita, Kansas, American missionaries in the Philippines, kidnapped last May. And in this video, in a jungle setting, the two of them together with immediately at their backs three heavily armed and hooded members, apparently of the Philippine group Abu Sayyaf. Bob Drogan, how did Reuters obtain this video?
little unclear. Somebody obviously provided it to them. What's also unclear is when this video was made. The Burnhams were in a video last November, and this particular one, which has just shown up, they actually appear to be a little healthier than they did then. They're wearing the same clothes they wore then, but they appear a bit cleaner. Mr. Burnham's beard is shorter. So there's some speculation that, in fact, this video was made before the other video, but they don't. I know that they don't know that yet. They're obviously trying to determine when it was made.
The United States, of course, has special forces in the Philippines now, assisting the Philippine Army in going after the Abu Sayyaf guerrillas. The tape, in its specific references to al-Qaeda and its links to Abu Sayyaf, does seem in some sense to justify the Bush administration's claim that this is part of the global terror network.
The Pentagon has put about 150 U.S. Special Forces down in the Basilan area, and they're backed up by another 500 or so intelligence assets, support troops, etc. They are ostensibly in a training capacity. They are going out on missions with troops. They are authorized to fire in self-defense. They are sending in P-3 Orion spy planes. One of the things they hope that'll do is provide thermal imaging from up high, which in theory will help them find people who otherwise would be hidden by the triple canopy jungle on Basilan Island. So they are steadily moving forward and clearly are determined to capture these guys. Abu Sayyaf is not a large group, 80 to perhaps 200 men. They have some support in the area because their ransom over the years, they've made a great deal of money or stolen a great deal of money, and they have apparently distributed some of that or shared some of that with local villagers. But I think Philippine officials I've spoken to and Americans seem fairly confident that this one is not difficult.
And the hopes at this point of the Burnhams being found alive?
Well, as far as we know, they are still alive. And obviously, as long as they are, then they plan and hope to retrieve them without injury.
Bob Drogan is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. It is a financial scandal. It smells like a political scandal. But whether the story of Enron will rival Watergate or Iran-Contra for political ramifications remains to be seen. As Republicans and Democrats gear up for November elections, the focus is all on bad books and lost billions. And while the financial shortcomings of Enron are being fully exposed, the public has yet to learn about political improprieties that may lie behind the biggest bankruptcy in U.S. history. Is Enron another Watergate in waiting? Does the Bush White House have something to hide? What will it take for the truth to come out? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from Beverly Hills, California, is John Dean, former White House counsel to President Richard Nixon. He's author of The Rehnquist Choice, The Untold Story of the Nixon Appointment That Redefined the Supreme Court. Good evening and welcome, John Dean.
Thank you.
Thanks for being
with
us.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Also joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
John Dean, it's almost 30 years ago now, but you've seen this drill, or the Washington scandal drill, up close before. You paid with 4 months in jail and an imprint on your life that we can only begin to imagine. When you look out at the profile of the Enron scandal, how does it appear to measure up to Watergate?
Well, it's certainly not a political scandal yet. As you said in the intro, it does have a scent of a smell of a political scandal, but it really isn't there yet. We haven't gotten into any serious political trouble with this. In fact, that's one of the gaps right now in the investigations. The financial side of the inquiry has been pursued pretty thoroughly already. What's not been pursued is how Enron got to the position it was in, how it was able to grow, how it was able to use its political muscle as it did to get regulatory approvals it wanted and have friendly politicians in high places that helped it along the way. That's really been ignored so far, and I suspect until it really is focused on, there won't be a political scandal.
John Dean, we want to dive into that tonight, but before we do, for listeners of a certain age, you will be remembered as a superstar of Watergate scandal era. When I mean that without judgment one way or another, but as a very large figure there. Tell us what you've done in the decades since. We know you've written a couple of books. You're an investment banker. Is that right? We want to have a sense of what perspective you're bringing to this issue today.
Well, I did, after Watergate, did go back to school. I actually didn't go to prison. I spent 120 days in the custody of the federal marshals in the Witness Protection Program.
Pardon me, I said jail. I should have said custody.
That's all right. I mean, it was a small difference, but I actually spent my time in the prosecutor's office because I was a very busy witness in those days. Mm-hmm. But after that, I came back here to California and went back to school and studied accounting, amongst other things, for about 5 years in postgraduate level. Went pretty far and pretty deep into accounting as a result of having only had a little bit as an undergraduate.
So maybe you're ready for Enron.
Well, I actually, in fact, my wife was a stockbroker and for years, and we both, looked at one point at the Enron portfolio or their prospectus and said, who would touch this stock? It was, the finances were just so complex. And it looked to me very early as a part of the bubble of the dot-coms anyway, so we stayed away from it. We actually did look at it.
And you went on then to become an investment banker yourself, John Dean?
Well, I did private investment banking. I promised myself when I turned 60, which I just did a few years ago, I would return to writing books, and that's what I have been doing and am doing. I'm actually working on a book on Warren Harding right now after mm-hmm. having done the Rehnquist Choice earlier this year.
So justice has caught your attention, and I guess we can imagine why that would be true. So you've written that when you look out at Enron, you see a roiling political story, a political scandal that just hasn't been told. Why do you suspect, we can all imagine, but you've got firsthand experience, why do you suspect that there's much more to be told here?
Well, one of the things that sent my antenna a-quivering is when Dick Cheney took the position he did on a rather fundamental and simple request from the GAO for information about his energy task force. It was just such an overreaction. He stalled long before it came to the point it is now. Over a year ago, almost a year ago, he started in April stalling and refusing the information. And it was a request as to who he met with and where they met and was federal money involved. And not the substance of the conversations. They had backed off the GAO very early on that, and it just made no sense to me. That's why I didn't understand that reaction. While he was claiming it was a matter of principle that the vice president and the president should have the right to get advice from anybody they wanted to, no one would disagree with that. But that wasn't even what was at issue.
Did you hear an echo of Watergate stonewalling there, John Dean?
I did, indeed. Those were all very familiar sounds to me, and it kind of got my attention, if you will. As you mentioned, I do write a column also. I write a legal analysis column and a lot of editorial stuff.
And what are your politics these days, John Dean? Do you have an axe to grind with the Bush administration?
I'm a registered independent in California, so I go both ways.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, John Dean, a voice from straight out of the heart of the Watergate scandal. We can all remember when he was front and center with that whole crew of Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Richard Nixon.
Yeah, right at the heart of it. And of course, John knows a thing or two about cover-ups. His Nixon talking to him, he helped to orchestrate the cover-up of the grand jury inquiry. And Nixon said to him, the way you handle it has been very skillful. So you learned at the feet of the master. But of course, he was covering up something, wasn't he? That may be the big difference here. I mean, one of the scenarios with Cheney is that this is just about vanity, and he dug in behind it, and it's taken on momentum. And if it shows anything, it may just show that he has a bigger role in the Bush administration than Bush, and maybe that's what he's covering up. I don't know, but let's get cynical about it when we come back, because when you're talking to a Nixon man, you can get real realistic.
Well, we'll get real realistic. We're joined tonight by former White House counsel for President Richard Milhouse Nixon, John Dean, who's written that he smells political scandal behind the financial scandal that's up front on the Watergate, on the Enron story. Excuse me, John Dean is Watergate. Do you remember Watergate? Does Enron feel familiar? Do you agree with John Dean that there's a political scandal in Enron that is still hidden? Do you smell a new Watergate here? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with John Dean, former White House counsel to President Richard Nixon in the heart of the Watergate scandal era. He's author most recently of The Rehnquist Choice, the untold story of how the Nixon appointment that redefined the Supreme Court. And the question is, do you remember Watergate, and does Enron feel familiar in that context? If there is a dark political scandal here, what is it? Will we ever learn about it? How will it be uncovered? Do you feel like we've got the whole story yet? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John Dean, Richard Nixon was famous for taping, and of course there's the famous exchange where you warn him that there's a cancer within, it's close to the presidency, it's growing, that he's being blackmailed. Richard Nixon says, how much money do you need? You said, I would say these people are going to cost $1 million over the next 2 years. Richard Nixon, you could get $1 million. You could get it in cash. I know where it could be gotten. So you've been there, John Dean, right down in the heart of the thing. Tell us, if there's a scandal going on here, you know how that chills the people who are on the inside of it looking out. If we're in a scandal, what part of the cycle are we in? Can you look back at the Watergate timeline and say, where are we here?
Tom, it's difficult to believe that people as intelligent as are now in Washington would not have learned something from Watergate. We wrote the book on what not to do. I don't think there is a massive cover-up going on, and that's one of the distinctions between Enron and Watergate, clearly. The fact that Nixon did have a lot to cover up, and it really wasn't just the second-rate burglary that concerned him. It was rather a whole modus operandi, if you will, within his White House, where he had been wiretapping newsmen and White House staff, where he had one of his senior aides had ordered a break-in in a Daniel Ellsberg psychiatrist's office. There was a lot of very, very potentially devastatingly damaging material had it come out before the election that was being covered up. So that was, as I say, it was more than just the break-in. As far as Enron being a comparison, what I can't understand is why Cheney and the Bush White House would not be forthcoming quickly. If anything has been learned about spin in all these years, it's get it out fast and as completely as possible, as early as possible, and don't let yourself get caught in even the appearance of a cover-up. So that's why I just don't understand what they're doing and why they're doing it, because they're smarter than that.
Do you sense a hunkering down here, John Dean?
Well, there's no question there's a hunkering down. This is an administration that has a true proclivity to secrecy, and it started before 9/11, and it started before the Enron scandal. That they are an administration that is very tight. The staff has been very closely approved. It's a staff that has very few leaks, unlike most White Houses, and the president has made it very clear, for example, with things like the Freedom of Information Act, they're putting clamps on that. He's reaching back to try to prevent the law that was enacted in the aftermath of Watergate to make presidential documents all available within 12 years of a president departing. He's trying to now invoke a new executive privilege over prior presidents and vice presidents, including his father's papers, that is really quite unusual. But as I say, there's a whole proclivity towards secrecy in this White House. And if anything we've learned, while you can't govern in a fishbowl, transparency is the safer course.
Well, that's interesting, though. You say you do see them hunkering down, but you don't see a cover-up. What's the distinction you're making there?
Well, obviously, presidents or any politician doesn't put out a press release when they make a mistake or if they have something to hide. There's clearly something going on where they have some information they don't want public, and they're fighting to keep it private. Now, whether the GAO suit will be the thing that forces it or not, I don't know. The GAO is just one of several lawsuits. There are also a couple other federal courts that are demanding that the White House release information sooner rather than later. So that suit may become moot before it's over, with two federal court judges telling the White House that they had to start turning over information.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, so far there's a kind of apples and oranges issue, I suppose, here. Watergate being such a political scandal and Enron being so far such an enormous financial scandal. Can we draw parallels? Are comparisons useful?
Well, to a certain point, I think, though, that one point needs to be made. This is if it is a political scandal, it's a field theory political scandal. Everybody's involved, from, you know, Joe Lieberman to George W. Bush. I mean, this is a systemic issue. I mean, the regulatory permissions that were granted to Enron, to Arthur Andersen, to others, was all about campaign finance and money slipping into these campaigns. In Watergate, the outrage was what was illegal. In Enron, the outrage is what is legal, which was the unprecedented access that money and gave Enron, Andersen, and others to the highest parts of our government. Mm-hmm. You know, in John Dean's article on this, he instances Henry Waxman's letter. Waxman is the California congressman who sent the letter to the GAO that instigated this suit to get Vice President Cheney to tell what happened at his meetings. And he lists some of the potentially improper influences by Enron in there, and just some of them. The White House energy plan includes no less than 17 policies requested by Enron. Cheney opposed price caps on California. So did Enron. Cheney intervened with India, which Enron wanted. Alternative minimum tax, Enron wanted it. Cheney, on and on. But the point is, all of this stuff is known, and all of this stuff is on the record, and all of it is legal. As I say, that's the outrage. Mm-hmm. That, in other words, John, I don't see the law here. Now, you are the lawyer here. Tell us where this gets to be. This gets to be incendiary stuff.
So far, the only potential law that I see that the task force might have violated is an antique that came up really back in the 1972. It was enacted. It's called the Federal Advisory Committee Act.
And you're talking about Vice President Cheney's energy task force here.
I'm talking about his energy task force. And there is a requirement, if literally two or more people outside the government get together with government employees, you have to comply with this act. And it's fairly stringent in what you have to do as far as opening your doors for multiple points of view and reporting and record keeping and what have you. That's one of the lawsuits that's been filed is looking at that issue, whether the Cheney task force violated that law. But they can't get any answers because they can't get any discovery. Hmm. And the judge has said that you're going to have to start turning over documents so we can look at that.
But John Dean, what about Jack Beatty's point that perhaps this is a real fundamental difference in kind here among political scandals, that this may be a scandal in clear view, simply a kind of drift into aiding and abetting in entirely legal ways a company that drove off a cliff when everything was taken too far?
It could be. The line between bribery and a campaign contribution is as fine as a frog's hair on his back. It is very, very thin line there as to where when you cross it. And whether there's any quid pro quo or not in any of this, that's one of the things, obviously, that is going to be looked at by the task force at the Justice Department that's investigating this to see if there has been any bribery or extortion.
Isn't this a case for a special prosecutor, John?
I mean, I don't think so. I think that the Attorney General has recused himself. The Deputy Attorney General is actually a former independent counsel. There is no independent counsel law, but that doesn't mean that the department can't appoint a special prosecutor. I happen to be one that has great belief in the career people in the Department of Justice, that they're not easily corrupted. They're incorruptible for all practical purposes, and that once they start an investigation, they will do it thoroughly and honestly. And I suspect that would have even happened in Watergate had an independent counsel or a special counsel not been appointed. They would have sooner or later gotten to the bottom of it. So I don't think that you have the entire U.S. Attorney's Office in Houston has recused itself as well. So you have a career team that is, in essence, almost like a special prosecution office that's looking at this and will do a thorough job. I don't think there's a need at this point.
So you have confidence that the Justice Department will, in time, bring to light whatever there is to be brought to light, if anything?
I don't think you can put the fix in the federal Justice Department. I do not believe it can be done.
Despite the appointees at the top?
That is absolutely correct, particularly because of the appointees at the top.
Jack Beatty, do you have the same confidence?
Well, of course, you know, all through, and what looks like small beans now, but the Whitewater scandal, I mean, people were charging that Janet Reno, for example, was essentially stalling and taking the most, really contradicting her professional staff on issues of, you know, whether a prosecutor should be appointed to investigate the vice president, for example. So there's an example, John, I think, of how, you know, I mean, at least people allege that she was clearly in the tank for her president.
Well, what she was doing is stalling the triggering of the independent counsel law. That's different than a prima facie case for a criminal investigation. That law had a hair trigger. It's one of the disasters that came out of Watergate. It was well-meaning, it was well-intentioned, and initially it worked well when independent counsel didn't get carried away. But what you've got with that law, or had with that law, is what they use to prosecute the mafia, where you know that there's misbehavior, so you put a task force, an organized crime task force, on a small group of people until you find them doing something wrong, and then you send them to jail. Mm. I don't think that anybody who's elected to high office, or indeed appointed to high office, really deserves that kind of investigatory burden placed on their shoulder during the time they're in office. I don't care if they're Republicans or Democrats. That law was a travesty, and now that both sides have been sufficiently gored by it, I don't think anyone's going to renew it. But I think that she was being prudent and not letting that hair trigger go off and starting, these endless investigations that get burdened every public official that the law got triggered by.
We're talking with John Dean. He's former White House counsel to President Richard Nixon in the midst of the Watergate scandal. He's looking at Enron and saying, golly, this looks like a ripe situation for political scandal, but that hasn't come out yet. Maybe it never will. Maybe there isn't one. But what do you think? Do you feel like we've got the whole story yet? Is the Bush administration sitting on a big scandal here or not? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jerry's on the line. Welcome, Jerry. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you.
Sure.
Fascinating to hear John Dean, who was clearly the most riveting character on the public stage in the Watergate era, and has many fascinating things to say this evening. I think the notion that Enron is a scandal is a curious one because, after all, Enron is a failed company. It may have been a Ponzi scheme. It may have been a financial fraud. But the notion that it's a scandal and that something improper happened because of improper inducements of public officials is ludicrous. It's come out enough that Enron was trying to get help from everybody it could. From well before the Bush administration took office, years into the Clinton administration.
Jerry, what do you make of Jack Beatty's thoughts that perhaps the entire political system was put in some way to corrupt purpose by Enron, that regulatory rules were created precisely to fit their needs, that campaign finance was provided in return for support for a business undertaking that ultimately turned out to be standing on hollow legs?
Well, I think that that's consistent with Jack Beatty's worldview, but I think it's inconsistent with reality because Enron crashed and burned, taking the value of its shares not only from the poor pensioners and workers, et cetera, about whom we hear so much, but the people whose net worth into the millions and millions went down in flames as well. These were the people who allegedly all these corrupt acts were done to benefit. So how did they benefit from this?
So Jerry, you would leave this in the category of a gigantic business failure, a problem of accounting and corporate structure, but not, by your lights, a political scandal.
I don't think it's a political scandal. It may be, in fact, an enormous business scandal. It may have been a completely fraudulent exercise I mean, the article in the Wall Street Journal the other day about a phony trading floor, which was filled with people who would talk to each other on the telephone whenever the analysts were brought in. I think there was a scene like that in The Grifters, which was one of these great con men movies.
Right.
And it is astonishing but, you know, the gullibility of the stock buying public has yet to be measured. I mean, people will buy anything that sounds good.
Jerry, John Dean wants to respond to your view.
Let me address the whole point of whether this is a scandal or not. A scandal really has two parts. There's been very little academic study of scandals, surprisingly, even though they're a part of our daily life. They seem to affect every presidency, certainly all the modern ones, but there's been very little study, and it takes two elements to have a scandal. One is you have to have wrongdoing, and then secondly, you have to have public censure of that wrongdoing. And here, most of the censure is actually coming from political figures, mm-hmm. some media figures. But if you recall what's happened in front of the House and the Senate when they've had investigative committees, it's been they drag somebody in, force them to take the Fifth Amendment, which I think is appalling, but they do it. And then they sit there and shake their finger at them, and they're the ones that are trying to make sure their own house is clean, and they're the ones who are, by definition, are really creating the scandal in this particular instance.
Perhaps, Mr. Dean, what you've identified is the real scandal, which is the vacuous posturing of American politicians. I worked in the Senate at the time of Watergate and just before, and my sense was that that the government was being more and more run by pygmies, and today I believe that's absolutely true.
Jerry, thanks for your call. John Dean, what about Jerry saying he doesn't believe it was a political scandal, but that if it was, it was a lousy one. Everybody lost money here at the end of the day. Is that a point of view that rings true to you, or is he missing something?
We've had political scandals, financial scandals that have also had political implications to them. The savings and loan scandals, the BCCI bank fraud scandal, all had political overtones to them. And those were really, of course, this SNL was a huge federal bailout. We don't have the same thing here. But it's still pretty early to tell if this is going to develop into a political scandal, because there's really been no focus on the politics of it. And yet we know that Enron was a very, very large contributor to, both sides of the aisle as well, predominantly Republican, but also many Democrats. And people, don't make big contributions without hoping to get something.
And Jack Beatty, just 20 seconds, but Jerry's saying your view of the world is not his, and he doesn't see a political scandal in all those regulations and regulatory maneuvers in Congress?
Well, I think the people that voted for the McCain-Feingold bill and for the bill in the House did. I mean, my point was that it was the system of camp, the legal system, that gives unprecedented access to these private interests. That's the scandal, and it was legal. I'm not,
Yes, it was entirely legal at that point anyway. We're talking with John Dean about the Enron scandal, about the backdrop of Watergate in American history, what's being done today. Do you remember Watergate? Does Enron feel familiar? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former White House counsel to President Richard Nixon, John Dean. He was there at the heart of the Watergate scandal. Now he's looking out at Enron and writing and talking with us tonight about his feeling that there is a political scandal in here somewhere that has not come to light. What do you think? Do you smell a new Watergate here? If there is a dark political scandal, what is it? Will we ever learn about it? How will it be uncovered? Where would you look for the thread to pull? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John Dean, we're talking about Enron, but with you on the line, Watergate, of course, is on our minds. Take us back just inside that Nixon White House when it began to dawn on people that this wasn't going to go away, that it was going to be a big problem. I don't know how big the circle was of people that knew, but what did it feel like in those meetings, in those rooms, sitting with Richard Nixon?
Well, it's interesting, as we've been talking along, I've several times have thought how little has really been written about the psychology of scandal. There are phases of a scandal, and very early, the first phase is typically denial. I had a, for some reason, the light bulb went off in my head way ahead of my colleagues. While I was a lawyer, I was not trained as a criminal lawyer, and I realize now in hindsight with that particular White House, the White House counsel had to be trained, a very highly trained criminal lawyer. But yet, as I say, slowly the light bulb went off. I can't even tell you today exactly when I crossed the line. There's no question I did, though. And I'm sure that's happening with the Enron people right now. They're assessing what they've done. Some of it they might have thought they had done with with the blessings of counsel or their accountants, and they're finding out that they've made mistakes. And this is a very painful, agonizing time.
But you're pointing past the Enron Tower. You're effectively pointing one way and another at the White House. Is it possible, John Dean, that your own personal experience with Watergate is leading you to see or to suspect a political scandal where, in fact, there may be none here?
No, to the contrary. I would be the first to hope that there was no more. We'd never have another scandal in Washington, never. I couldn't wish that on anyone. If anything, I have a point of view of believing that how could people be as dumb as we were? As I said earlier, we've written a book on what not to do, and a lot of those people that are in Washington, that are there in that administration, for example, Cheney and Rumsfeld, they were all around during Watergate. So these are not unusual events for them to have to deal with. But as I say, I'm not trying to make a scandal out of this. I'm just raising the issue of what's going on given the behavior. We have a propensity of this administration to keep everything secret, to keep it hidden, to hold everything close to the vest, and that raises questions. It's an exact reversal of the way the government has been going, which is to become more open. We've had, where some states have had enacted sunshine laws. The federal government has gotten closer to that as well. And we have, for example, as governor, Bush doesn't want any of his papers to become available, even during his gubernatorial years.
John Dean, let's turn to the telephone lines. Jason is on the line. Welcome, Jason. You're on the air.
Hello. First, I just want to say I think there's no question there is a business scandal, that Enron was guilty of fraud and misrepresentation. But in terms of trying to turn this into a political scandal, I think so far it's wishful thinking on the part of people who endured 8 years of Clinton bashing and Clinton being tied into all sorts of scandals and people looking for anything to get revenge on the Bush administration.
So, Jason, we've heard plenty about the financial side, and you're saying you think this is just looking for something where there's nothing, or enjoying the discomfort of the Bush administration that had Enron blow up on its watch.
I think it's possible there might be something discovered down the road, but at this point, I really don't think there's a scandal. I really do think it's a case where, people would love to see the Bush administration caught in scandal, both Democrats in Washington and the people that didn't vote for Bush and have some bad taste in their mouth after the election. So I think that's a big part of it. I think if there were a scandal, it would have been if Washington did something to bail out Enron, which there's no indication they did. That would have been scandalous. But what happened is really just a clear-cut example of how our system is set up politically and how it works. People with money have access. They get legislation passed. Like it or not, that's still legal.
Jason, thanks for your call. John Dean, Jason's saying, well, this is just the way the system works. He doesn't believe there's a political scandal in here.
I don't necessarily believe there is either. I'm just saying my antenna are up. But, I'm right now working on a book on Warren Harding, and I've been looking at the Teapot Dome scandal fairly closely. That really is a scandal that, while it has tarnished the Harding legacy, the president himself was absolutely uninvolved. There is not a scintilla of evidence that he had anything to do with it. Yet it is, the people and historians who should know better have tied him to that scandal and have made his scandal. Before Watergate, that was the most memorable presidential scandal was Teapot Dome.
Mm-hmm.
So you never know how these things can affect a presidency.
Jack Beatty, the compass points seem to have become blurred in a way here. I mean, we know about all the financial, the campaign contributions that were made by Enron. We know the legislation that was passed. We know the contributions that Enron made to George W. Bush's and George H.W. Bush's campaigns, very substantial, including those from Kenneth Lay. But the moral compass seems blurry. You hear in our callers a sense that, well, this is just the way the game was played, and so let's not be throwing mud on the bushes now.
Well, I'm not throwing mud on the bushes.
Oh, I don't. I'm not saying you, Jack.
Yeah,
but it just,
right. No, sure. But you know, let's get cynical for a bit. I mean, I think we're allowed to do this here. You know, what could be some of the strings that would unravel? Well, there were 3,000 partnerships that Andrew Fastow, the chief financial officer of Enron, created to hide about $500 million in losses. 3,000 partnerships. We know the names of maybe, 10 of those partners? Who are the partners? What are we going to find out about them? Secondly, the California connection. You know, the California energy crisis, I mean, John, you can speak to this, but as I understand it, even Gray Davis now is getting a reprieve from that, because they really are looking into whether the degree to which Enron manipulated the market in California. And you had Dick Cheney basically saying the Enron line. Now, was the motive there? We want Gray Davis in all the trouble he can possibly be in, because while we don't expect to carry California, we would sure like to have a Republican governor there in 2004. Am I being too cynical here, John Dean?
Well, there are a lot of wonderful what-ifs, and I hint at them in some of my writing on this subject on my Fine Law columns. But, you know, and the California crisis is certainly one. In fact, Enron's handling of California has been very poor. They may well be held in contempt by the state of California because they've refused to provide any documentary evidence to answer any of the questions of the state legislature, which is investigating it. And the state Senate has that question right on its platter right now. What I think is going to happen, what I think is really going on here, is the Congress is not unusually keen on starting a political investigation right before the 2002 elections, which are just months away now. If the Democrats prevail and were to take control of the Congress, I think you're going to see a much more detailed and politically oriented investigation of Enron. If the Republicans take control of both the House and the Senate again, I think this issue is going to go away. That's where I think it really is. When you get down to cutting it down to what really is going to happen, is going to happen.
John Dean, we're going to have to let you go, we know, but give us, before you go, your last memory of Richard Nixon, the great political scandal man.
A very complex man. As Bob Haldeman once said, the former chief of staff, probably the weirdest man to ever sit in the Oval Office.
Well, there you go. John Dean, former White House counsel to President Richard Nixon, author of The Rehnquist Choice, The Untold Story of the Nixon Appointment That Redefined the Supreme Court. Thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Pleasure, Tom.
Jack Beatty, there is a blast from the past, and you hear the natural rising of the antenna from John Dean, but then not exactly sure where to point them yet.
No, and I think he gives us an interesting political take on this. A lot will depend upon what happens in this election and, of course, what happens in this war. I don't think the public has any stomach here for a protracted inquisition into this just because of the circumstances the country finds itself in. One line from Warren Harding out in his letters in Ohio State to a lover: I love you clothed, but naked more.
Ooh.
What a poet.
Something to think about, Jack.
Thanks
for leaving us with that.
Presidential quote, folks.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can read John Dean's article, Political Scandals Past and Present, Watergate, Iran-Contra, and now Enron. It's on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. Tonight, a diary from Ron Barrier of New York City. He was a first-hand witness to the September 11th attack on the World Trade Center. He's the national spokesperson for American Atheists Incorporated. They are an advocacy group that lobbies for the absolute separation of government and religion. Ron Barrier says that he was moved by the caring and unity he witnessed on September 11th. He has not been encouraged, however, by the actions of political and religious leaders in the months since the tragedy.
September 11, 2001 has had a profound and curious effect on American society. There was an immediate feeling that Americans were suddenly united. We had found our sense of community. Our preoccupation with biases and prejudices dissolved as they were replaced with mutual help, mourning, and healing. On that day, I witnessed humans helping each other in ways we only dream of. Your skin color, theological interests, economic status, even your sexual preference were all irrelevant. Ironically, Osama bin Laden had managed to accomplish what our own elected officials and religious leaders continually failed to do, unite Americans. However, that feeling was short-lived. Under the guise of civic unity, religious leaders feverishly made sure that all public expression of mourning and grief were covered with a veneer of religious faith. Many Americans recited the slogan, "God bless America," as if this would undo what had already been done. God became a buzzword for citizenship, loyalty, and war. Religious leaders and elected officials all but equated incorrectly a link between civic duty, religious faith, and patriotism. Our public officials went right to work exploiting September 11th. Senator Istok of Oklahoma revived his constitutional amendment to restore organized prayer in public schools and insert the word God into the Constitution. Governor Rick Perry of Texas justified religious services to Jesus Christ in the public schools by implying that the Constitution did not apply during crises such as September 11th. In Alabama and Virginia, there exists a rush of bills supporting the placement of the Ten Commandments on public property, especially in public schools. In Washington, D.C., there's a bill to make God Bless America our national hymn, and many states are spearheading legislation to force school children to recite the politically altered version of the Pledge of Allegiance. In the aftermath of September 11th, people prayed to a variety of gods for a variety of reasons. And what were they praying for? Why were they asking a God to bless us? After all, the attack on the World Trade Center was faith-based. Did not the perpetrators of this terrible crime also perceive themselves as blessed by their God? I've seriously considered the concept of a God and the role this God would play in the wake of September 11th. The more I thought about it, the more I became convinced that the only role a God would play would be the role written for it by humanity. The phrase, ever since September 11th, holds little meaning for me. It means more religious browbeating, more sacrifice of our civil liberties, more excuses to trump personal freedoms and privacy, more empty sloganeering, and more elected officials willing to sacrifice constitutional principles on the altar of religious ideas. What September 11th does mean to me is that we have not learned very much. We'll continue to indulge in what Ari Fleischer calls our blessed lifestyle as irresponsible and insatiable consumers. We will continue to dictate to the rest of the world what we can and cannot do. We will continue to widen the gap between the haves and have-nots. We will continue to worship the gun. And most importantly, we will continue to be the number one supplier of weapons to the rest of the world. September 11th has cast a little more light on what Morris Berman aptly calls the twilight of American culture. Or, as David Byrne once noted, same as it ever was. Same as it ever was.
You may ask yourself, what is that beautiful house? You may ask yourself, where does that highway go to? And you may ask yourself, am I right? Am I wrong? And you may say to yourself, my God, what have I done?
Ron Barrier lives in New York City. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Are events in the news affecting you in a personal way? If you have a story, an insight that would make a radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.